big, warm, wintry welcome to the Misadventures in Music podcast from me, Mick Ord, and fresh from his latest musical triumph at his annual Christmas show in Liverpool, Ian Prowse.
Hiya, how are you doing, Mick?
All right. Have you recovered yet?
We partied for 2 days afterwards, which at my age is a ridiculous thing to do. But you can't say no, can you?
No. Great stuff. Frank Zappa once famously said, "Most rock journalism is people who can't write interviewing people who can't talk for people who can't read, thereby insulting the three people taking part in this podcast today and effectively everyone else listening." His humour was certainly misplaced in terms of our guest today, who spent 30 years at the top of his trade in music journalism in the UK, starting off at the NME during its heyday in the late 70s, becoming editor of Q magazine in 1990 and later Mojo. He's interviewed McCartney, Springsteen, Madonna, Pavarotti, Bowie, Jagger, Van Morrison, and goodness knows how many other icons, and has written acclaimed books on Lennon, McCartney, and the music culture of both Liverpool and London. Paul Denoyer, how are you?
Hi, it's great to be here. Thank you for inviting me.
It sounds good, put like that, doesn't it?
Sounds like hard work.
It sounds amazing because Lennon, obviously, you missed out on. For kind of obvious reasons, I guess. But you would have interviewed him, Paul, because you were at the NME at the time and it was the biggest music paper in the country.
Yeah, he was talking about coming back to Britain in the 80s and doing a tour. And had he done that, I'm sure that at some point I would have done him for the NME or for Q or for Mojo or somewhere along the line. I would have met him, which would have been absolutely great. So that's my one, I think, deep regret that I never got that opportunity.
And Dylan, have you interviewed
him? No, he's done very few interviews in his time, and it's a very tricky thing to interview Dylan. I don't, much as I love him, I don't really regret not having had to undergo that ordeal, you know.
NME in the 70s, the mid-70s to the 80s and beyond, it was the music paper, wasn't it, Ian? It was the place where you went to find out what was happening.
Yeah, it was. If you were in a band, you know, that was got signed and you were putting records out, what the NME said about you was absolutely vital. And it was, you would literally stay in the house for 2 weeks if you got a bad review. You certainly wouldn't be seen on Bold Street. If you got a good review, you'd walk up and down Bold Street about 20 times a day. Yeah. It carried that much weight. All of the music press did, to be honest with you.
It did, but the NME was the one that was, it seemed to me at the time, it was onto punk before the others. It was onto new wave before the others. Reggae and all that. Is that fair or is that just me being romantic?
I think the other big papers were Sounds and the Melody Maker. But the NME was the leader of the pack in terms of circulation. So by virtue of circulation, it was probably the most influential. It also had the most attitude, I guess.
Yeah.
Which is why
had intelligence to it, didn't
what it said seemed to carry more weight, I think. Had the best writers, I believe, not just me, but I was so honoured to join those guys, you know, Nick Kent and Charles Shaw Murray and all that. I couldn't believe that I was in their company.
What was it like going into the office when you first started?
When I was first starting, it was very...
Were they all just like doing heroin in front of you?
There was a little room around the back called the reviews room, which had no windows.
Oh, did
and that was that was a room that had a distinctive smoky atmosphere. But they were quite welcoming once you got to know them. But it was an intimidating place to go in as a brand new freelancer.
Yeah.
Because in those days, obviously, there was no email or anything. You had to go in with your tatty piece of paper and bring it up to the commissioning editor and pray that they'd accept it. Bit by bit, I worked my way in, and so then it was my turn to be intimidating to young freelancers.
So you did.
When they came in.
It was funny, wasn't it? Because unlike now, every single review you might read, they all seem positive, even if the records might not be particularly good. But back in the day, they just seemed to be a lot more honest. And if a huge artist brought out a substandard record, they'd just tell you. You know, they didn't seem in hock to anybody. They'd just come out and say it.
Yeah, I mean, I did like that about the music press at the time. It was very, it was kind of iconoclastic. They didn't, I mean, it was sometimes it was a bit cheap, because it's always easier to be entertaining if you're as a writer, when you're slagging something off.
Yeah.
That's easier than praising something. Yeah. And I mean, I wasn't myself a particularly vituperative writer. I'm not that kind of personality. I'd much rather write about something I enjoy than try and get a cheap laugh out of slagging somebody off.
Did it help coming in from Liverpool?
It was certainly no drawback to have a Liverpool accent and be identified as a Scouser. Might have been different if I'd gone into the law or medicine or something, I don't know. But to be a music to be in the music business generally.
Yeah. Same for
it
all
was a great
us.
It was a great thing, you know, to have that heritage behind you.
All of us getting signed was the same thing. There was A&R men crawling all over you as soon as you hit your first chord, just because of the reputation of the city. Yeah. So I imagine it's the same thing.
It's nice that we had a calling card that worked in at least one industry in the world.
The only one, probably. Well, let's face it, the band that were most responsible for that, the first song we're going to play is actually I'm Down by the Beatles. Why have you chosen this one, Paul?
Partly to represent the Beatles, but more specifically, this is it's a Paul song. It just demonstrates what a great rock and roll voice he had and still has. You know, contrary to the kind of glib stereotype of John being the rocker and Paul the balladeer, this shows Paul at his rocking best. And a quirky little fact is that he recorded this on the very same day that he recorded Yesterday. So that's imagine doing this and Yesterday on the very same day. The two opposite extremes of his pop repertoire, at least. So I think it's a great tribute to Paul himself. And I've got to represent the Beatles in that list somewhere, because everything, as you say, stems from them, really.
You tell lies, thinking I can't see. You can't cry because you're laughing at me. I'm down.
Singing's unbelievable. We did a Little Richard recently, didn't we?
Yeah.
And you can definitely, hear that coming in on it with everything that he does, yeah.
Yeah, I think Little Richard was always Paul's main inspiration.
Was he?
For that side of his music.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, definitely. And the subject matter there, before we played that, you were saying, there are the stereotypes about what Lennon did and what McCartney did. This was a down song, a bit like Help, wasn't it? And the stereotype says, oh, no, that's bound to be John Lennon. That. And it, of course it wasn't.
Yeah, it's got, I mean, Paul always did have quite an edge to him when he chose to apply it. So he wasn't the soppy kind of wimp that some people have dismissed him as.
I've spoken to you about this before. And in fact, this is the podcast I've been most looking forward to doing since you told me that Paul was coming in, because obviously I've known you a while anyway, and read quite a few of your books. And so you've told me before that you always consider people think like Paul, John was the mad one and Paul wasn't. You said, well, they're both quite mad in their own way.
there's something really deeply strange about McCartney's repertoire when you look at it, the avant-garde things that he did. Just the strangeness of...
I went to his farm on the... I played a show up in Kintyre about 6 weeks ago, and I got took to the farm. Wow. It's about... you'd never find it. I knew somebody, and we got taken up there, and it's miles and miles and miles up there. And you just kind of look and think, what the hell was he doing here? You know, at the height of his fame. Yeah. So that's kind of, that made me think, what sort of a guy is he? You know, and which I love, obviously, you know, that he should just go, right, I'm going there. Yeah. You know, it's a wild place.
Yeah. I'd love to have... I'd love to go somewhere like that, where you know they've been, and just get into the head a little bit. I mean, you've known him a lot. You've done a book with him. You've editorial consultant. You know him as pretty damn well, as much as any other journalist in the UK.
Probably as much as any journalist. I still wouldn't say that I knew him particularly well. Because he presents one side of himself to you. It's not like, I wouldn't say I was a personal friend. I mean, we're on friendly terms, but I never claimed to be a friend of his.
No.
I think he's pretty unknowable, to be honest. He's very easy to get along with, but that's not the same as saying you really know somebody. And he's a very adept interviewee. I mean, he's been giving interviews for longer than most of us have been alive. You know, it's very difficult to catch him out, and it's very difficult to catch him off guard as well. Yeah. He gives away pretty much what he chooses to give away, and nothing much beyond that.
It's as if every time there's a new round of interviews, he's had a think, and he's going to tell us a little bit more about this, that, or the other. Yeah. And it kind of it's a bit of a tease, really, because it kind of makes you just think, wow. And then, but you're right, I'm not sure that you ever get quite underneath the bonnet, so to speak.
No, I don't.
But why should we? I mean, obviously, you know, it's up to him, whatever he wants to reveal.
Yeah.
But it's still fascinating to anybody who loves any music. And it's just getting more and more fascinating, I think, the whole Beatles thing.
Yeah.
As we get further and further away, I think by the time the last two of them leave us, Liverpool's just going to become like Stratford upon Avon on steroids, you know.
Yeah, yeah.
Just any scintilla of information, you know.
I mean, with the Conversations with McCartney book, they contacted you, didn't they, Paul?
Well,
at least that's what I read.
I think I was probably just talking to his people, his manager or the people in the office, saying, you know, blimey, I've got about 30 interviews now. I've been talking to Paul for on and off for however many years it was at that point, 30 years or so. You know, why don't I assemble it all into some kind of book form? And they said, well, we'll have to run it by Paul, you know. So, because actually a lot of that material is his copyright, because a lot of the interviews were done as work for his company, sleeve notes and tour magazines and press kits and that kind of thing.
During all this time, has the Liverpool connection between the two of you, has that helped, do you think?
Oh, no, it certainly did, because as far back as 79, I suppose, when I first met him, that was in Liverpool at the Royal Court. He was doing a little press conference in that cellar bar there. And, of course, he picks up immediately when he hears a question in a Liverpool accent.
Oh, does he?
And he turns his full gaze upon you. On every occasion since then, he would remember that I was the guy from Liverpool, and he gradually gets to know you a bit better. And
I remember that because I was 14, And it was on the Radio City News that there was a queue to buy tickets for Paul McCartney and Wings' Back to the Egg tour, I think it was, to Liverpool. And they said the queue had started, the tickets were on sale at 8 o'clock on Sunday morning, the queue had started at 12 o'clock on Saturday afternoon.
Wow.
And I said to my mum, I should go and get tickets. And she said, you're only 14, you can't sleep out in the streets of Liverpool, but I'll let you go this one time, just so I could get her and me dad tickets.
Oh, way. What a star.
And me and my best mate Murph, we slept on the streets all night long. And that was an experience I'll never forget.
And did you get a ticket?
Yeah, we got 4 tickets.
Oh,
yeah.
Wow.
Yeah. But I didn't enjoy the show because I was 14. I was into the Jam and the Clash. And Paul came on doing Wonderful Christmas Time and all that. And it jarred with me, you know.
Yeah.
It was only years and years later I saw him that I absolutely adored it, you know.
Yeah.
When I was 14, I didn't really like it.
And it also turned out to be the very last Wings tour.
Oh, was it?
Because the next stage of that tour was to take place after Christmas in the Far East, beginning with his arrival at Tokyo Airport.
To be
intercepted by the Japanese customs. Yeah. And that was the end of that tour. And indeed, that was the end of Wings. And didn't play live for another 10 years after that.
Did that drug bust end Wings effectively?
He tried to get them back together a little bit later, but the momentum had been lost. He even said to me once, he wonders if he, at some kind of subconscious level, he was hoping to get busted. He wanted something that was going to give him an exit strategy from Wings because the whole thing was kind of dying inside for him.
Right, yeah.
He was very vague about this. He says, I still don't know. I still don't know. But it's as if I willed this thing to happen.
Yeah.
Because he's willed himself to get banged up in a Japanese studio.
Yeah. It was about 9 days or something.
Something like that,
wasn't
it? Yeah.
And didn't he just put the marijuana on the basically gave it to them? Gave it to them. I've got this with me, you know.
I know. Well, there were all kinds of theories, you know. One was that I won't go into that.
Go on.
Tell us later.
He's behind you.
No. But for you as a human being and as a writer your whole life, I guess that proximity to Paul McCartney, it's a hell of a thing to have done, isn't it?
I mean, I soon got over the stage fright.
Did you?
of having to sit across the table and talk to him, because it became so routine. It was never boring, of course, but I did get to the stage eventually where I could just treat it as a normal conversation. It was like meeting anybody else.
Which, of course, again, he is. He's just a
fella. He is. I was just reading somewhere the other day, somebody described him as a very ordinary genius, and this sums him up for me, because in person, he's really good at just being an ordinary bloke, and he's very good at putting everyone in the room at their ease.
Yeah.
But at the same time, you've got to keep in mind that because of the work that he's done, people will be talking about him in 1,000 years' time. You know, he belongs to history.
And, yeah, he really does, doesn't he?
You can never quite overlook that fact as well.
I think now,
self-facing in person.
Yeah, I think now as we, you know, he's in his 80s. I just think about what it'd be like when he leaves us, and I just think it's going to be an outpouring of love and emotion like we've never seen, and it'll be bottom up. You know, like we have, we had like the Queen and Philip, and that was top down. You know, you must mourn. But I think when Paul goes, it'll be an absolute tsunami of
and it'll
feelings.
Be pretty much worldwide as well. It won't just be here.
Yeah,
it'll be
soundtracked, obviously. You know, and there's so many beautiful songs. I was listening to I'm Carrying this morning.
Oh, yeah.
What a fabulous song that is that never gets mentioned.
Yeah, yeah.
You know,
yeah.
as a songwriter myself, I just think you bastard, you know. But it's inspiring as well. Yeah.
When you were nattering with him, or when he was nattering with you, Paul, during the conversation, were questions coming into your head and you're thinking, no, but I hadn't ask him that? Were there any off-border questions that you thought, no, I bet I didn't go there? Or did you just go in? Did he know what you were going to ask him before?
Very often with interviews in general, there's a sort of understanding as to what this interview is going to be about. Because after all, you know, the vast majority of interviews are done for some promotional purpose. very few people give an interview because they want to sit around and chew the fat with a music journalist. They're doing it because they've got an album or a tour or whatever. And it was the same with Paul. You know, each interview was done. And very often the agenda was set up by him and his company. I was working for them often. I wasn't an outside journalist. There was always a certain territory that you had to cover. But conversations being conversations, and he himself is quite a discursive kind of talker. He will go off at tangents. So you never quite knew what you were going to cover. I suppose I would try and steer things around to what I thought would be interesting. But as I say, McCartney is such a professional, and he's been doing interviews for, you know, since I was in the infant school. So you can't really get the better of him.
Yeah,
long may he reign.
Yeah.
Well, I want to play now the second choice, which was "Instant Karma" by John Lennon. And after that, we'll talk a little bit about what you would have liked to have asked him.
Instant karma's gonna get you, gonna knock you right on the head.
You better get yourself together, pretty soon you're gonna be dead.
Karma's gonna get you, gonna look you right in the face.
Better get yourself together, darling.
Join the human race.
Such was my disappointment at watching Paul McCartney and Wings, and how kind of MOR it was the day after I went out and bought Shaved Fish.
Oh yeah.
Which is a kind of a compilation album, wasn't it?
Yes, that's
just
right.
To reignite my love of the Beatles. So and that is obviously part of that. Yeah. He did a whole load of kind of singles, didn't he, at that time?
He did, yeah. The early 70s, he had a great run of late 60s, early 70s. He had a really great run of singles.
I'd say,
overlapping with the end of the Beatles.
Yeah, and the Plastic Ono Band album. Arguably, it's the best solo album. just because he just cuts the veins and puts it on the vinyl, doesn't he?
Yes, I know. Yeah. It's not the easiest of listens, no. I think.
But
particularly
God,
compared to Imagine, which followed yeah. it, is the one that the whole world loves.
Yeah. And, but the songs in it, I mean, God, for example, yes. you know, arguably the moment of Lennon's recorded career, because he's just the honesty I'd never seen or heard before. Because
yeah.
a lot of, you know, like Bob Dylan, they'll couch what they want to say in poetry or whatever it is. John Lennon didn't do that on this album. He just said it directly, didn't he?
That's right.
And it was mostly trauma.
Yes.
So that's why that particular record just really resonates.
Yeah, yeah. And he was working with Phil Spector. I mean, Instant Karma is also a Phil Spector production. Which is not too surprising because it's got that big Phil Spector sound to it. But the Plastic Ono Band album is a very stripped back thing. There's no wall of sound going on in that. It is a Phil Spector production, which you wouldn't necessarily
expect. It's radical, isn't it, in emotionally and everything, that record?
Yes, it is one of the most powerful.
Did Lennon say to him, I don't want the full pipe and drums with this one, I want it to be stripped down, do you think? Or
I don't know. I don't know what the conversation was.
They must have, though. It kind of, for me, that album just really does bookend the Beatles experience for him.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, for We All Shine On, Instant Karma, I mean, that was conceived as let's have a party in the studio, and they rounded up hundreds of people to sing along, you know, so the concept was always, this is going to be, it's like Give Peace a Chance or something. It's going to be, it's a big party with a microphone, you know. Uh-huh. Whereas the Plastic Ono Band, I think that was always deliberately conceived as a very stark thing. It's just, there's me, there's Ringo on the drums, there's Klaus Voormann or whoever, but that's it, you know. There's no bells and whistles going to be, and there isn't going to be a great big gang to sing along the chorus.
There isn't really what kind of like a, like a hit single off it either, is that there's not a big catchy song really.
No, I think Working Class Hero is the one that most people would recognise, but even that wasn't the kind of pop single type of
not at all
option, I don't think.
If we got the Ouija board going now and we made contact with him, what would, as Liverpool's greatest ever music journalist, if you don't mind me calling you that, what would you ask him? What would be your first question? You get one shot at it, and we know it's definitely him.
I don't know what I would, that is my greatest professional regret, that I didn't have this chance to interview him. And it was great to do Paul so many times, but John would probably be in an even more rewarding interviewee, because he was a lot more forthcoming than Paul generally is. And I always think, apart from anything else, he would have been really easy to interview, because he's one of these people with whom you could just bring your tape recorder in, press the record button and say, over to you, John. Yeah. Because he would be able to just hold the floor himself. Yeah. It wouldn't matter what stupid little questions I brought in on my reporter's notepad. You know, John would take the floor, and he'd be full value for the next hour, you know, or 90 minutes. You know,
scouse-gobshitery, isn't it? It is.
I know. I mean, I wrote this book. The first book I ever did was called We All Shine On, about John's solo years. And I thought the great thing about the solo years is that he tells you everything about his own life anyway. You know, you hardly need to interrogate him, because he lays everything so bare in those early albums, particularly the first one, The Plastic Ono Band. But then Mind Games, Walls and Bridges, even Double Fantasy, in a way, they're very revealing of what was going on in his life.
Yeah. I think Double
He never hid anything, did he? Hmm? He didn't hide anything. It was mostly trauma.
He would say, sometimes, I mean, to be honest, everything is showbiz. I dress things up so that they've got to be a kind of an entertainment.
Yeah.
But at the same time, he's pretty much ripping a page out of his diary, out of his private diary, and putting it to music.
Double Fantasy as well is just honest. He's talking about his son and his family in a way. And that's probably why I don't like it, because I don't want to hear songs about, you know.
But when you listen to it, there's a lot about him and Yoko arguing. Yeah. There's a lot about them not getting on. There's quite a bit about you know, secrets being kept between from yeah. each other and all that kind of thing. So even there, there's a fair amount of candor.
I think that you scratch a bit. There's one of the songs, you probably know which one, where he says, "No friends and yet no enemies." Mm. And you're thinking, okay. He's saying that as a way of saying, we're happy as we are, but it's quite a claustrophobic phrase, that, isn't it? You know, because you're thinking, what's your life beyond that, you know?
Yeah.
What do you think he would have gone on to do good stuff? Or do you think it would have been a bit up and down like it was before? Some people say it. I mean,
I think it would have. I mean, I think it's bound to be up and down. I mean, no one can work at that peak of artistic achievement forever. I mean, Paul didn't, in all fairness. I mean, I think he's had peaks and troughs in his solo years. So is Dylan. Dare I say it, so is Springsteen. You know, not everything is absolutely top notch.
Well, apparently, the record that was on John's turntable when he got shot downstairs was The River.
Oh, right, yeah.
And so maybe he was starting, if he was coming back into the industry and he was going to start writing again, maybe whatever Bruce was doing, you know, speaking about blue collar lives, especially on the River album, maybe John would have been turning to that and going, okay, well, I can relate to this.
Yes.
I guess the thing about Double Fantasy, which didn't resonate with me, was it happened, you know, in the middle of a massive, the biggest musical explosion of my lifetime in punk and new wave.
Yeah.
And none of it at all.
Yeah. I mean, you were also still a very young man.
Yeah.
And it is about, it's an album about middle age. It's about, John said himself, he kind of thought of the album as him reaching out to his own generation, saying, hi, here we all are.
Yeah.
We're 40.
Which is great as well.
How did we all get here? How are you doing?
Yeah.
How, you know, he's talking to the 60s people.
It's an original way of looking at it, that, isn't it? Thinking, I'm not writing for the kids. And his last song that he was working on was Walking on Thin Ice, which, if he hadn't have died, might have, I don't know whether it would have been number one, but it might have done, because it's quite kind of 80s sound in that, isn't it?
It's very contemporary. Record, it's a fantastic track, Walking on Thin Ice.
So anyway, what would you ask him? Sorry, I forgot. Bring you back to that. You got one shot.
No, I think, to be honest, if I'd met him in, it would have been 19, let's say it was 1981. He died at the end of 1980, didn't he?
Yeah.
He was talking about coming back to Britain.
And Liverpool
in 81 and doing a tour. And you would have had to say, John, where have you been? What's kept you? You know, because there have been so many books about him and so many revelations. But at the time, we didn't know what the hell he'd been doing since 1975, and we did think he'd done some kind of Howard Hughes number. He'd locked himself away in the Dakota building, you know, he'd probably grown his fingernails 6 inches long and a beard down to the floor.
Yeah.
In fact, he did none of that. He was always busy. We now know that he was making tapes constantly. He was traveling around the world in a very low-key manner.
Yeah.
He was raising his new son, Sean. Yeah. He was leading a pretty normal life. Yeah. He was going out to art galleries with Yoko. Yeah. Going
as we know, just
he was leading a very normal kind of life. But
when
we
the kids
know,
arrive as well,
we thought there must be some secret. Something going on with John.
And there wasn't.
There wasn't. I don't think. But I would have asked him that anyway.
Yeah. Well, there's one of those things. They had that aspect of homeliness about them. The Beatles, I think. In amongst all of the surreal stuff, there was some like homely northernness about them they used to use as well.
Yeah.
And maybe in his own head, he was, you know, it's just his version of Mendips and bringing up children.
I think, yes. That's the interesting thing about Double Fantasy, I guess, because it was, again, going back to these Lennon-McCartney stereotypes, everybody always thought of Paul as family man at heart, bit pipe and slippers, really.
Yeah.
Whereas John is the rebel, you know, the eternal teddy boy. But in fact, by that stage, John was becoming every bit as domestic, I think.
Yeah,
for the time, for at least for as long as he had left to live. Yeah. We don't know what he would have been like in his 50s and 60s. God knows, he could have grown old disgracefully. I wouldn't have been surprised.
Okay, well, we're going to go with another Liverpool-born artist now, Billy Fury. The title Wondrous Place, which was the title of your your book about Liverpool musical culture. So we'll play this. This was originally from about 1960, wasn't it, Paul?
Billy's version, I think, was 1958. But it's an older song. It's an American song he covered.
Because when it came out a couple of years ago, everyone was saying, wow, this is great. I couldn't believe it.
It wasn't a big hit when he first put it out. So I discovered it through a reissue at some point. But I didn't remember it from first time around.
I found a place full of charms. Oh, magic world in my baby bazaars. Her soft embrace like satin and lace. A wondrous place. What a spot in the storm. To cuddle up and stay nice and warm. Away from harm in my baby's arms. A wondrous place. Man, I know when I'm anywhere else, but I don't get everything's right when she holds me tight. Her tender hands on my face. I'm on heaven in the embrace. I wanna stay in love.
Okay, now this is the bit that gets me excited, because for anybody who doesn't know, Paul's book about Liverpool, Wondrous Place, is, in my opinion, the best book about Liverpool per se, not just about music, because the book doesn't just talk about all the bands that have done well out of Liverpool punching above its weight. It talks about what makes Liverpool, and the observations in the book are beautiful and incisive. And I really want there to be another edition, Paul, because I only became anything like successful way after you stopped doing them. So I'd like to be included. but yeah, it was when did it come out? It was quite a while ago now, wasn't it? There's three editions so far.
It's been in three editions. I think the first one came out in about 2002.
Yeah.
And the third... The most recent edition came out in 2008. That was done for the to coincide with the Capital of Culture.
Yeah, yeah. And in the book, there's some... you basically try and work out why Liverpool is so prodigious with it, with music. And there's some great chapters, and I love the one particularly about Ireland and the influence of Ireland being... the main one, you know, the all-pervading one. And you say that if Irish people are green, then the modern Liverpoolian would be a delicate shade of mint. Meaning, obviously, that, you know, the influence of the Irish, where everybody at one point was Irish, first born even, these days we are all partly Irish, and it's kind of, it's still sort of there, isn't it? Even to this day,
I think I was always conscious of the Irish dimension to Liverpool life. All my grandparents were Irish.
Yeah.
So my teachers were all Irish priests. my wife is Irish. Dublin was kind of my second hometown beyond Liverpool.
Yeah.
So that aspect of Liverpool culture was instantly recognisable to me. It always felt very natural, and
Could the image, that thing of, could the Beatles have come from anywhere else, you know, with three of them being Liverpool Irish?
Yeah, it's hard. It is hard to imagine. I mean, I as you say, I did try to look into the reasons why this great musical explosion did take place in Liverpool, and you can point to various the Atlantic seaport that had the connections with through the sailors. One of the obvious things, the Cunard Yanks and all of that kind of thing. The influence of the different immigrant communities, and so on and so on. But in the last analysis, I thought, I don't actually have a last analysis. One of the reasons I liked the title Wondrous Place was that, A, it's a nod to Billy Fiore, God bless him, but also it's just this word wondrous, which kind of leaves you with a sense of, do you know what? I can't really explain this away for you.
Yeah, you say
know,
that.
There's still something marvelous and
a beautiful thing in the book, which are kind of, it's basically what same as what you're saying there, where there's this curious feeling in Liverpool, and I don't know if you'll get onto this, Mick, but that we're all in a play.
Yes.
You know, we're all kind of in this cosmic huge play, and everybody's taking part in this play in the city, and it's a very difficult thing to explain, but when I read it in the way you put it in the book, I immediately know what you meant, you know.
I was probably prompted by that. There's a line in Penny Lane about she feels as if she's in a play, and she is anyway, or whatever it is. But because of my career, I've spent my life shuttling back and forth between Liverpool and London, so every week or 2 weeks I'm in one place or the other, and I always have, takes me about a day to kind of decompress in the new city, because I'm still kind of feeling the city I've just left. And this aspect of Liverpool always strikes me. I'll get on a train and I'll get on Merseyrail to go off to where I'm staying in Liverpool.
Yeah.
And you look around and everyone kind of clocks you. Everyone is kind of aware of everybody else.
Yeah.
Whereas when you get on the tube at Euston, that doesn't happen. No. Everybody is locked into their own private universe.
Yeah,
you know?
Yeah.
If you get on the bus, more so than the train in Liverpool, it's odds on that somebody will talk to you at some point.
It's so true.
That would be a once in a decade event in London.
Well, you say that wonderful thing in the book as well, where obviously the best way to enter Liverpool is by sea. You know, if you come in because you've fallen in the steps of our ancestors and all that sort of thing. But you say, but the second best way is when you come in by train, because you enter a series of 18, 19 tunnels into a dark underworld. And then when you finally come out at Lime Street, it's like you've come into a different...
Yeah.
You know. Yes, you have, absolutely. I've loved this...
A different country.
I've loved this kind of topographical aspect of Liverpool. It's like a circle. Half the circle has got the sea. It's bounded by the sea or the very broad river estuary.
Yeah.
And the other half of the circle is a big sandstone ridge. So at no point in the old town could you see England.
No.
You could see Wales, but you couldn't see the main part of England. No. Liverpool is so enclosed, and it's almost like geography is destiny. There was something about the physicality of Liverpool which kept it apart from Lancashire, even.
Yeah. It's the accent, isn't it? It ends abruptly.
Yes.
And then all of a sudden they're speaking like they're from up north again.
I grew up in Anfield to begin with, and then later on we moved out to Magull, which is on the northern outskirts of Liverpool. And it was bizarre because the housing estates that people like us had moved to were full of Liverpool people.
Yeah.
But down the road, there'd be a field and there'd be a brown brick farmhouse across the field.
Yeah.
And if you went there, the people would be talking with a completely different accent.
I had exactly the same experience in that I grew up in a satellite town of Ellesmere Port.
Yes.
And in an hour, cul-de-sac was a council house building. We were all first in there. My mum and dad still live there, the last ones in the street, and everybody from the street was Liverpool overspill.
Yes.
So the whole street, the whole of the town, it's Liverpool or Everton and Scouse accents. There's no, there's no rugby, there's no, like, none of that northernness. Yeah. And then, you know, later came to live in the city centre. But it's really having one foot from over there and one foot inside it is a curious thing, but a really, really good thing for me, for creativity and songwriting. I'm not in the middle of it that I have never seen outside of it. Yes. Do you know what I mean?
Yes.
And same with you coming back and forth from London.
Yes.
You see both sides.
Getting, if you want to write about something, having a bit of distance.
Yeah, exactly.
I mean, I'm ludicrous of me to bracket myself with James Joyce, but of course we all know that these intimate x-rays of Dublin were written long after he'd left the place. It was his imagination was supplying all the kind of things that... it wouldn't have supplied had he still been in the middle of the of the actual.
I think you need
place
that,
itself.
You know, and knowing it so intimately, Liverpool musicians, people who come in, people who go out, there's a creativity does thrive on being away from it. Like it's important.
I think that's definitely true. That, and that's a good point about the play thing, particularly when you go away. I don't feel it so much now, but when I was younger, I used to feel there was a bit of a spotlight on me. The minute you'd open your mouth, certainly in the 70s and 80s, someone had asked you a question about it, whether it was about music, whether it was about politics, whether it was about Boys and the Black Stuff. Someone would ask you a question about it. And so you did feel like you were sort of representing the city, you know?
Yeah. It does mark you out. I mean, I always feel when I'm down in London, they think I'm one of the boys from the Black Stuff. But when I'm up in Liverpool, they think I'm something out of Brideshead Revisited.
I never
quite click in either place.
Well, you do that great bit in the book about the lost art of the Liverpool gentleman, you know,
which
I really appreciate as well, you know. Is it George Melly and Adrian Henry and those sort of people, which is a big part of, you know, what's gone on in the city
as well. Yes, it is. And Liverpool does have a... I mean, Liverpool's got a great... Liverpool has a middle-class history as well as the working-class history.
But it's a city, isn't it? So it's a big place.
It's a big city. It's a big city.
It's not Derby or...
The Dockers did kind of did a lot to shape the character, as did casual labour in general. That shaped a lot of the Liverpool character. But, you know, if you go down to the pierhead, look at those three graces, look at those millions of little windows. Don't forget who worked behind all of those little windows. It was shipping clerks and insurance brokers and so on and so forth as well. So the history is just bigger and more diverse and it gets painted sometimes, I suppose.
Sure. Well, I'm not going to try and forge a link between our discussion from the past 5 minutes with the next record, which is by Coco Taylor, and it's Wang Dang Doodle.
Just wanted to include something in my list that referred back to the blues, because that's been one of my basic musical loves. Back from when I was a kid, I listened to all the pop radio, Radio Caroline and Top of the Pops and all that stuff. But my grandmother in Walton, she took in Lodger's Irish students. This is in the 60s. And a lot of these, it must have been the time of the blues boom, and these students had blues records, Muddy Waters and Sonny Boy Williamson and Johnny Hooker and stuff, and they'd play this stuff to me. So this is my introduction to a kind of music that was outside the mainstream, and I thought, I'm the only lad in my school who has ever heard of the Chess label. Maybe I wasn't, but I thought I was.
Do you think this inspired you then to become
really,
a scholar
I just
music.
Loved it, and to this day, the blues has been is the thing I will come back to.
Is it?
Maybe country music as well, but certainly the blues, and... years later, they allowed me to start up my own magazine after I'd been editing Q magazine, and I called it Mojo because I thought Mojo the blues is like the blues is like the X-ray of rock music. The blues is what gives rock its structure and its architecture. It's what holds it upright, you know. So I thought, if I'm going to go start a magazine that's going to get deep into the story of rock music through the years, then Mojo is a reference to the blues. That's a good starting point.
And needless to say, it's the most successful music magazine still going in the country.
We thought
right
of
now.
It as a bit of a niche thing when we started, but it's practically the last man standing now in that music magazine market.
Fair
unfortunately,
fair play to you for even you know.
Yeah, just reached its 30th anniversary.
Is it?
Crazy. Okay. I must have about 60. Of the free Mojo CDs that you used put out.
Yeah.
Fantastic stuff. I've still got a load that I haven't even opened yet, you know.
Yeah.
But it was groundbreaking, Mojo, because it seemed to me at the time that you were aiming for, I know you'll shoot me down in flames if I've got this wrong, but a slightly older demographic. So people who weren't maybe buying many CDs as it was, with very, very new artists, but they were still had an interest in music, and you would refer back, so you'd do features on bands from the 70s, bands from the 80s, bands from the 60s. So it was about our musical culture more than solely about what's happening now.
Yes, I think the rationale behind it was that there is a big audience that's growing older. There's no point hiding from the fact that we're all growing older, and Q had been a recognition of that fact. I'd been on the NME and in the Music Weeklies. I think we were all kind of conspiring to think we were all like Peter Pan. We were never going to grow older. I left the NME when I was approaching my 30th birthday because I thought, this is going to get a bit stupid, you know, if I'm going to go into my 30s writing as if I've still got the attitude I had when I was 18.
Yeah.
And pretending I'm still 18. Luckily, some of us got Q going, and that allowed us to become people of a certain age.
Do you still write now? Hmm? What are you still writing now? Have you got anything on the go?
No, Mojo invite me to do things now and again, and I usually decline because there's not that much I feel fresh about.
Okay.
But the magazine is still going well. But I always wanted the magazine to be kind of open to younger readers as well.
Yeah.
So we would have, they do still have lots of quite young, very young acts. It's not cozy, it's not nostalgic. It's mostly about quite extreme kinds of music. At the time, I thought, if you came into music via The Clash or Captain Beefheart, then you're not going to slowly and gracefully retire into Valdunican world.
No.
That had been the music industry assumption before that. I thought, if you started with these firebrands and madmen, you've got to kind of keep a place in your heart for firebrands and madmen for the rest of your life.
My music is more radical than my 12-year-old.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah, yeah. I always wanted that. I wanted a place where older people could read about some new music and younger people could read about old music as well, stuff from before they were born. So I wanted that kind of two-way traffic to exist, and I think we managed to achieve that.
Did you ever think of at the time having Mojo Radio or something? Or did you have it? Because I remember at the time, because I was working in the radio industry, thinking, wow, I could listen to a playlist based on this magazine.
Just at the time, launching the magazine was hard enough. I mean, that gave me the grey hairs on my head, just getting the magazine off the ground. In later years, I know the media company that owns it would be thinking in those kind of multi-platform synergy terms, at which point my head would have slumped onto the table in despair. And I think there might be a Mojo Radio, I don't know, but I'm not involved in that side. There's a website and all that kind of stuff.
Well, you did the Liverpool book, Wondrous Place, but I read the London one as well.
Yes, in the city.
Which was fabulous. So in the city?
Yes, in the city.
Because, you know, my formative bands, the two absolute classic with the Jam and the Clash, and obviously, you know, with the Stones and everything else that had come through London. I was just thinking, if you ever did another city, what would you, is the one that you feel as though has been not done that you want to do?
I'd grown up in the time of Merseybeat, and obviously I was immersed in the Liverpool thing, and I spent most of my career covering Liverpool bands, but I was also living in London. And even as a kid, I'd loved the Kinks and the Small Faces. Yeah. They were my favourite pop bands, I think, beyond the Beatles and the Stones. And heritage going on with those people through to Madness. And even the Sex Pistols are a kind of music hall act.
Yeah, they were, yeah, yeah.
But beyond Liverpool and London, I'm not close enough to any. I did think about Dublin because that had been a big part of my growing up, but I thought, no, in the end, that's for a Dubliner.
Yeah, you don't know what goes on in the, like Sheffield, for example, would be a great book, wouldn't it?
But I think it needs to be for a native or someone who's lived there.
It's in their veins to get into the psyche of it, which is why the Wondrous Place Liverpool book is so good, because you get right into the psyche of what makes this city so different, you know?
Yeah, and crucially, like you said before, you've got that distance as well, so you're not too imbued with the myth and the reality, you know, like it's clear, isn't it? If you're not here all the time, then you've got that, you can stand back and
yes, it was funny. I did write Wondrous Place mostly in London, and I did write In the City mostly in Liverpool. It's just the way it worked out. It was kind of a relief, really, to emerge, just to be.
It's been the Liverpool book has been a great help for me, as a source and inspiration. Having written, you know, quite a few songs about Liverpool on our last album, we had a song called Holy, Holy River about when people put their loved ones' earthly remains into the river and then they get to go all around the world, you know, which is like a Liverpool sort of spiritual thing. And I've got a friend who calls the Mersey the Ganges of the West, an old hippie mate of mine, which is fanciful, but I love it, you know, and it's...
I am a sucker for all that kind of Scouse mysticism.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah, it's great, isn't it? But in your book, there's that. I can't remember what the name is, but I use it on stage sometimes when I'm talking about Liverpool. About in the Liverpool Echo death notices where somebody had put. I can't remember what the name was. It was a vaguely Liverpool Irish name. Come on, Jerry, you've bounced back from worse than this. In the death notices.
The death notices of Liverpool Echo. I haven't seen them for years, but they used to be a bit of an art form.
Well, we all know that elder members of the family would just pick up it, go straight to it, the death notices, and then start going, oh, Michael's dead. And you'd never heard them mention a Michael before in their entire life,
no,
you know.
No.
That was a good money earner, the BMDs in the Echo.
Yes, that's
death
right.
And death. Yes, I mean, that's good money earner. That's obviously no longer there.
No, so I mean, that's part of the reason for the problem.
I used to like reading the gangster obits because you can tell paragraphs of people saying what a great bloke he was when he was last out 20 years ago. You know.
Yeah. Tony Evans, the Liverpool sports writer, who also lives in London now, he's just done a great novel. Based around Vauxhall and Scotland Road, and he talked about all of that, you know, the gangster world of it all. But they're like all kind of gentlemen as well, but mad, you know, and Scouse.
When Tony Wilson died for his funeral in Manchester, a little group of us in Liverpool, music scene people, we got together to organise some flowers for him to say with love from Liverpool. But the word Liverpool was in gigantic flowers. And I think it was, people said it was the most conspicuous thing in Tony Wilson's funeral procession was the word Liverpool. But I remember, who was it?
We probably got one over on the Manchester.
I think it was Kevin Sampson said to me, oh, I know just the florist. She's really great. She does the gangsters and everything.
No better testimonial.
Yeah, brilliant.
Next one is Dusty Springfield and one of her collaborations with the Pet Shop Boys. What have I done to deserve this?
Quite a few of my choices seem to come from the 1960s or earlier, so I thought I'd bring things bang up to date with something from 1988. But the reason I chose this one was firstly because Dusty Springfield was the first pop star I ever saw. She at the Liverpool, it was at the Liverpool Empire in 65 or so. Weird thing, it was a panto just a typical Jack and the Beanstalk type panto, but in the interval they'd have a pop singer on,
right?
And then Dusty Springfield came on at the end to close the whole show.
What song did she do?
Well, she did about five or six. Oh, okay. She had loads of big hits at that time. I can't remember now. I can kind of guess what they would have been. But she was just such a dazzling sight. I'd never seen a pop star in real life on the stage. And, of course, she was so fabulously glamorous at that point.
Yeah.
It was just such an astonishing thing. And I also chose it because it's a nice example of somebody whose career had a beautiful upturn before the end. You know, she was approached, I think, by Neil Tennant of the Pet Shop Boys, who said, you know, let's do a few songs together. And she had this great song. It's as good as any of the great things she did in the 60s. She did a few things with the Pet Shop Boys.
Great
I always love that. I always love it when that happens, when somebody brings out some... I interviewed her around this time as well, which is another big thrill for me, because meeting people who were big pop stars when you were a child is far more exciting than meeting any... I mean, I'm not trying to be cute, but it was much more of a thrill to interview Dusty or Cilla Black than it was to interview Madonna.
Okay.
I mean, Madonna's great, and it was very interesting to meet her, but you don't feel that same kind of...
No.
Almost stage fright, you know.
Yeah.
Bloody hell, I am talking to actual Dusty Springfield, you know.
She's what was she like with you?
It's fantastic.
What was she like?
Dusty Springfield was great. She was really sharp, really witty. I didn't know that much about her, but she's actually very Irish. You know, her real name is Mary O'Brien.
Who is it?
Her full name is Mary Bernadette Teresa Carmel. You know, one of those kind of names, O'Brien. And there's still that kind of London Irish. There was this London Irish sharpness around her. She was very, very funny. And
they thought she was black originally, didn't they, when their voice came on the radio?
Very possibly.
Yeah, they thought she was a soul singer.
You know. Soul was... she came up through this kind of folk trio, the Springfields, with her brothers. But soul music was a really big influence on her. And she had a very soul... I don't know whether she sounded black or not, but she had a very soulful voice.
Well, that's a soul record. The Pet Shop Boys, isn't it, really, when you know,
certainly
when, you break
when
it
she
down.
Comes in. That's one of my favourite bits of the record. When it's a lovely Pet Shop Boys 80s pop thing, but when she comes in, it's just transported to a higher level. It becomes transcendent.
Yeah, absolutely.
I love that moment.
Another great and sadly missed... singer now, Amy Winehouse with Love Is a Losing Game.
For you I was a flame. Love is a losing game. Five story fire as you came. Love is a losing game. What we made.
immediately identify the authenticity, couldn't you, when you listen to her? That was the thing, wasn't it?
Yes, she was a great... it's obviously a tragic loss to music. This track is particularly poignant because it's her own composition.
Yeah.
And it sounds like a standard. You know, she recorded with Tony Bennett, and it sounds like one of those things that she would have done with Tony Bennett. And yet she wrote it herself.
Wow.
It does sound like the kind of song that people should be recording
so
versions of the next 50, 60 years, you know, same as any of those Bennett, Sinatra kind of standards. I interviewed her very early on. She was just on the cusp of becoming famous. I interviewed her in, it was just a tapas restaurant in Camden Town. And it was just one of the last days when nobody looked around. Nobody gave her a second. People probably did give her a second glance because she was a very striking young woman.
Yeah.
But nobody knew her as being, you know, Amy Winehouse, the pop star, because she hadn't reached that stage yet. And I had a lovely afternoon with her, and we walked around Camden doing photographs and all of that kind of stuff. She was really good company, and she really liked the interview. And it was just such a lovely day. I remember it. It's just a very fond memory. And I never met her again after that, but I had to, from a distance, observe, you know, the madness of 21st century celebrity, which I think is a far harder thing to cope with than any previous form of celebrity, given, you know, we live in the age of the internet. Everyone's got a camera on their phone. The media is much more voracious, given over to writing about rubbish when they should be writing about something a bit more useful. So, I mean, that was a malign influence on... It wasn't good for her placidity, you know. Mm. Plus, the people around her sometimes probably didn't do enough, didn't make the right interventions, didn't make the right calls.
No. It's so easy, so easy to forget that it's only the music that counts.
Yes.
Everything else is bollocks, isn't it?
Yes.
Everything, you know. The fame, the money, the attracting partners, whatever... If you could just stay on the music, keep focused on it, you might get saved.
Yeah,
you know?
Yeah. Part of her problem, which the thing I did pick up on when I interviewed her was she was very tense because she was such a perfectionist. Already the word was coming from the studio and from the musicians. You know, God, she's a bit of a nightmare to work with. They used to say the same thing about Dusty Springfield because she was such a technical perfectionist.
Yeah.
And she would get up and she would tell these engineers who were there just having a fag and reading Practical Electronics. She would say, no, I'm not doing this. We're going to do it this way. And they're all thinking, who the hell is this girl who's telling us how we...
young girl.
You know, where the needle's got to go, for God's sake. And Amy was exactly like that from what I gather. And she's saying, but she would say, look... In the end, it's my name. It's going to go out on that record. And it's not going to go out until we've got it completely right.
Yeah.
And I think she, in that sense, her perfectionism made her life harder. And
she was
never satisfied. It's not like she could say, well, a lot of my life is rubbish, but didn't I make a great record? She never thought she made a great record.
Right. So wow.
That's curse of her kind of artistic purity.
The final choice from you, Paul, is Marvin Gaye. His Eye Is on the Sparrow, which is, am I right to call it a gospel song?
I think it's it is actually an old gospel song, apparently, which he's given a more, this is from 1960s, 1960, he's given it a 1968 kind of a Motown feel. But I think originally it was an old gospel song from the Southern States, I guess.
Should I feel so discouraged? I want to know why should the shadows come? Tell me why should I feel so
so lonely, so lonely. And long, long for a heaven and a home.
I loved it because I wanted to, although it's by no means a typical Motown soul song, but I just wanted to get him in there, Marvin Gaye, because he, I mean, that represents another major strand of my growing up and listening to. In those days, it was called, in Britain, it was called Tamla Motown.
Yeah.
Through
some
kind of quirk of licensing, wasn't it? And people would say Tamla.
Yeah.
Parties. And say, got any Tamla?
Yeah.
And we had a record player in school in the common room, and it would be, play some Tamla.
Yeah.
And, and someone would bring in some hurry prog record. And play some Tamla. I'd bring in T Rex and say, get it on, get it off, play some Tamla. So I wanted to represent that strand, not just Marvin Gaye, but Smokey and, you know, the Four Tops, all of those people. And from the South, Aretha, all of that gang, you know, they had to be in the...
To me, that this music you're talking about, it feels like my indigenous music.
Yeah.
Because of every family wedding, every christening, that's all we ever played. So yeah. Since I was, you know, no months old, it was what we always played. So it's the most ingrained music in me.
Yeah.
You know, even to this day, if Jimmy Mac comes on and it takes me by surprise,
yeah.
by the time it's the second chorus, I'm just a mess.
I mean, I've always loved rock music, but there's no doubt about it. There are lots of very bad rock records.
Yeah.
But there is almost no such thing as a bad soul record. You just, you know, you literally cannot go wrong with a Motown record.
No. You know? You listen to them all and they're all brilliant, aren't they?
Yeah.
Did you ever go to the Top Rank?
Yes, I did. It wasn't my kind of place, but I do remember going there.
No, I missed out on that. That was a club in St. John's Precinct, wasn't
Yes, it was. Yeah,
and it was Soul and Motown and lots of fighting from what... That's what the urban myth said. I never actually went.
They did put on occasional gigs of the sort that I... Mostly in those days, I would have gone to Liverpool Stadium. That was a regular venue, all those. I saw Bowie, and Bowie is the other kind of major thing in my life. And, saw him at the Ziggy Stardust.
Did you interview Bowie? Hmm? Did you interview David
Quite
Bowie?
A lot, yeah.
Did you?
After McCartney, Bowie is the bloke, the person I had the most to do with down the years.
What was he like? gotta ask you.
It sounds stupid. It sounds trite, but the thing you remember about Bo is that he had very good manners. It seems a really inadequate way to describe this extraterrestrial man of such extraordinary profundity and strangeness, but he had very, very good manners. I liked him. I liked him very much. But I only knew him in his later sensible years. I didn't know him when he was completely off his head. He was a perfect gentleman in the later years.
I feel like running through all the famous rock stars we know. Did you know him? Like, did you interview Beefheart?
No.
Beefheart? No, I never. Never crossed paths.
You've done Springsteen, though.
Sorry?
You've done Bruce Springsteen.
Springsteen, yes.
Yeah, we've had this conversation.
Just the once. Yeah. But he was everything you would wish for, you know. Yeah. First thing he did was go to the fridge and get me a beer. And I thought, yep, you are Bruce Springsteen.
Yeah.
Brilliant. You're not an imposter.
Well, you met him, haven't you?
Yeah, I met him. And my daughter's called Rosalita, obviously. So I showed him a photograph in New York. We went to watch him and I got to meet him. And he just said, oh, man, she's adorable. And we said, when are you going to come to Liverpool? And he goes, I'd absolutely love to come to Liverpool. So it's still in the pipeline that he's going to come and play Anfield or somewhere.
Right, yeah.
I said, do you need a support act? Then he got whisked away.
On that bombshell.
Yeah. I will send my lawyers after you, Prousey, though. That was it.
Oh, well, look, Paul, great seeing you.
Yeah.
After
thanks, Paul.
Such
thanks
a long time. We'll put links out to your books in the episode notes.
Oh, right, yes, thank you.
And I know you're not sure whether you're going to write again, but I think we both can say we hope you do.
Hope you do.
Thank you. I'll never say never.
Yeah, definitely.
There's still plenty more to be written about this mad owl place, isn't there?
Yeah.
And we know absolutely. For a fact there'll be more great music coming out of it. So
all the best, and thanks a lot for coming in.
Thank you, mate. Thank you both. It was great.